So much. I'm a little surprised to realize that I do too. I have to say, look, I guess you know I've always had questions about your brother. I rest my chin in my hand, thinking. But a dropped ring at a murder site is a little too convenient, isn't it? And none of it fits with Katrin's anonymous messages or what we think might have happened with Brooke and her car. Too many puzzle pieces, Malcolm says moodily. We lapse into silence for a few minutes, watching the defender, until a light knock on the doorframe startles us both. It's Peter Nilsson, looking casually handsome in a polo shirt and khakis. He has a crystal tumbler in one hand, filled with ice and amber liquid.
You two all right? Need anything?
Malcolm is silent, so I speak up. No, thank you. We're fine. Mr. Nilsson doesn't leave immediately, so I feel like I should make more conversation. Plus, I'm curious. How is Katrin doing, Mr. Nilsson? We miss her at school.
Well.
He leans against the door with a sigh.
She's devastated, of course. It's good for her to have some time away with her aunt.
Is that her mother's sister or yours? I ask.
Mine, Peter says. Eleanor and her husband live in Brooklyn. We don't see them as often as we'd like, but she and Katrin had a nice visit last month.
Malcolm stirs beside me on the couch.
They did? Sure. Katrin went to New York, did some shopping.
Peter's brow creases slightly.
That was my interpretation, anyway, by the number of bags she brought home.
I don't remember that, Malcolm says.
You and your mother were on vacation, Peter says. It was a last-minute thing. Eleanor's husband was out of town for business, so she flew Katrin down for the weekend. Although she almost didn't make it. That was the night of that hailstorm, remember? The plane was delayed for hours.
He chuckles and sips his drink.
Katrin kept texting me complaints from the runway. She has no patience.
I'm sitting close enough to Malcolm that our arms are brushing, and I can feel him tense at the same time I do. My entire body goes numb, and my pulse starts to race, but I manage to speak.
Oh, that's so frustrating. I'm glad she made it there eventually.
Mr. Nilsson's eyes wander to the screen.
The Defender, huh? That's your mother's movie, isn't it?
Yeah. She only had one line, though.
I don't know how I'm still talking normally when a million thoughts are zipping through my head.
That does not compute. At least it's a memorable one. Well, I won't keep you from it. You sure I can't get you anything?
Malcolm mutely shakes his head, and Mr. Nilsson turns and retreats back into the dark hallway. We sit in silence, my heart hammering so loudly that I can hear it in my ears. I'm sure Malcolm's is doing the same.
Fuck,
he finally breathes. I keep my voice to the lowest whisper possible. Katrin wasn't here on Labor Day weekend. You and your mom weren't here. There's only one person in your house who could have driven Katrin's car that night.
Fuck, Malcolm says again. But he wasn't here either. He was in Burlington.
Are you sure? Malcolm gets to his feet wordlessly and motions for me to follow. He leads me upstairs to his bedroom and shuts the door behind us, then pulls his phone out of his pocket.
He said he had dinner with a guy who used to live here, Mr. Coates. He was my scout troop leader. I've got his number in here somewhere.
He scrolls for a few minutes and presses the screen. I'm standing close enough to him that I can hear a faint ringing sound, then a man's voice.
Hey, Mr. Coates. This is, Malcolm Kelly.
He laughs self-consciously.
Sorry about the blast from the past, but I had a question for you.
I can't hear what Mr. Coates is saying, but his tone is welcoming.
Yeah, so, Malcolm continues, swallowing hard. I was just talking to my brother. You know, Declan.
Right, of course you do. He's majoring in political science, and he's interested in doing, like, an internship or something. I'm probably not supposed to be doing this, but Peter mentioned he had dinner with you last month, and there was a chance you might have some kind of opening in your new firm.
He pauses and waits for Mr. Coates to speak, his cheeks staining a deep red.
You didn't?
On Labor Day weekend?
Another pause.
Oh, sorry. I must have heard wrong. I was just, you know, trying to help my brother out.
Mr. Coates talks for a minute. Malcolm nods mechanically like Mr. Coates can see him.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot. I'll have him call you. That'll be really helpful. Thanks again.
He lowers the phone and meets my eyes.
You hear that?
Enough.
Peter wasn't there, Malcolm says. He lied.
Neither of us says anything for a beat. When I raise a hand to tug at my necklace, it's trembling so hard that my fingers knock against my chest. Let's think about this, I say, in a voice I have to fight to keep steady. It sounds like Peter was probably here, driving Katrin's car the night of the hailstorm. But if Katrin wasn't in the car when it hit something, or someone, why would Brooke be involved? Why would she help get the car fixed if she...
Oh.
I grab hold of Malcolm's arm. The pieces are falling into place, and this time I might actually be right.
Oh my God, Mal. Katrin said Brooke took off during a sleepover once, remember? She thought Brooke was slipping out to hook up with you. What if she was with Peter?
That's impossible, Malcolm says, with no conviction whatsoever. His eyes are like glass.
Think about it, though. If Brooke and your stepfather were having an affair, which, ew, but I guess that's the least of our problems right now, we've been looking at everything wrong. It's not just about the hit and run. It's about keeping everything quiet.
I pull my own phone out of my pocket. We need to tell Ryan about this. He'll know what to do.
I've just opened a new text window when the door flies open. It's like watching some alt version of my life to see Peter standing there with a gun pointed straight at us.
Your poker face needs work, Malcolm, he says calmly.
His pale hair glints silvery gold in the dim lighting, and he smiles so normally that I almost smile back.
Anyone ever tell you that?
Chapter 35. Malcolm. Thursday, October 10th. All these weeks of wondering what the hell was happening around town, it somehow never occurred to me that the guy I trust least of anyone might be involved. I'm an idiot, and Ellery sucks at solving true crime, but none of that matters right now. I'm going to need your phones, Peter says. He's still in his polo and khakis, but he slipped on a pair of gloves, too. Somehow, that's more chilling than the gun.
This isn't a drill, kids. Put them on the side table next to the bed. One at a time, please. You first, Ellery.
We both comply, and Peter waves the gun toward the hallway.
Thank you. Now come with me.
Where? I ask, glancing over at Ellery. She's frozen in place, her eyes trained on Peter's right hand. His nostrils flare.
You're not really in a position to ask questions, Malcolm.
Jesus, this is bad, colossally bad. I'm only just starting to grasp how much shit we're in, but I know this much. Peter would never let any of this unfold if he planned on leaving us alive to talk about it. Wait, I say. You can't... Look, it's too late, all right? We found the receipt from Daly's auto and gave it to the police. They know something sketchy is going on with Katrin's car and they'll figure out you're involved. Peter's expression flickers with a second's worth of doubt, then relaxes again. There's nothing on that receipt that points toward me. There's the fact that you're the only family member who was at home to drive, I say. Peter raises his shoulders in a careless shrug.
Brooke borrowed the car and had an accident. Simple enough.
I keep talking. I just spoke to Mr. Coates. I asked him about meeting up with you that weekend, and he said you never did. He knows you lied.
I listened to every word you said, Malcolm. You told him you must have heard wrong.
Mom was there when we talked about it, I say, hating the desperate edge that's crept into my voice. She'll remember. She'll know something is fishy.
Your mother will remember whatever I tell her. She's a remarkably compliant woman. It's her greatest asset.
I want to kill him then, and I think he knows it. He takes a step back and lifts the gun so it's pointed directly at my chest. I strain to keep my expression neutral as my brain cycles through every possible reason why it's too late for Peter to get away with another murder. Officer McNulty was there when Katrin said Brooke snuck out during a sleepover to meet up with somebody in this house. If she wasn't coming to me, it had to be you.
If you're not here, there's no reason for anyone to think it wasn't you, Peter points out.
Shit. I wish Ellery would snap out of whatever trance she's in. I could use another brain working right now. People are going to question another murder, another couple of murders, especially if your stepson is involved. First your daughter's best friend and now me. This is going to come back on you, Peter, and it'll be 10 times worse when it does.
I agree, Peter says.
He looks completely relaxed, like we're chatting about baseball scores or the latest Netflix series. Not that we've ever done either of these things.
Now is absolutely not the time for anything even remotely resembling a homicide. I have to insist you come along, though. Downstairs. You first, Ellery.
Hope pulses through me, even though the coldness in Peter's eyes tells me it shouldn't. I contemplate lunging for him, but Ellery's already moving toward the hallway, and he has the gun trained on her back. I can't see any choice except to follow, so I do.
All the way to the basement, Peter says.
He keeps his distance as we troop down 2 sets of stairs. The Nilsson's basement is huge, and Peter tersely directs us through the laundry room and the finished space my mother uses to exercise. The past week flashes in front of my eyes as I walk, torturing me with everything we missed. There's so much to regret that I scarcely notice where we're headed until the biggest revelation of all hits me. When it does, I halt in my tracks.
I didn't tell you to stop, Malcolm, Peter says.
Beside me, Ellery pauses. I turn slowly, and she does too. Cold sweat coats my face. Declan's class ring, I say. You had it. You dropped it near Brooke's body in Huntsburg.
And? Peter asks.
Declan never got the ring back from Lacey. She still had it when she died. She hadn't stopped wearing it. You took it from her. Because you...
I hesitate, waiting for some sort of signal that he's affected by what I'm about to say, but there's nothing on his face except polite attentiveness.
You killed Lacey, too.
Ellery draws in a sharp, shocked breath, but Peter just shrugs. Your brother is a useful fall guy, Malcolm. Always has been.
Did you... Ellery's eyes are locked on Peter's face. She tugs at the silver pendant around her neck, so hard I think she might break it. "Did you do something to my aunt, too?" Peter's calm expression doesn't change. He leans forward and whispers something in her ear, so faint I can't catch it. When she lifts her head to look at him, her hair tumbles across her face, and all I can see is curls. Then Peter raises the gun again so it's pointed directly at her heart. "Is this a thing with you, Peter?" I'm so desperate to get his attention off Ellery that my voice bounces off the basement walls. "You hook up with girls your daughter's age and kill them when there's a chance they might expose you? What did Lacey do, huh? Was she going to tell?" A sudden thought strikes me. "Was she pregnant?" Peter snorts. "This isn't a soap opera, Malcolm. It's not your business what happened between Lacey and me. She overstepped. Let's leave it at that." The gun swings toward me. "Move a few steps backward, please. Both of you." I do it automatically, my thoughts tumbling and swirling so much that I barely notice we're standing inside a room. It's in the farthest corner of the Nilsson's basement, piled high with sealed cardboard boxes. "This is the only room in the house that locks from the outside," Peter says, one hand gripping the edge of the door. "Convenient." He slams the door shut before I can react, plunging the room into darkness. I'm at the door seconds later, first twisting the doorknob, then pounding so hard that my bruised ribs flare with sharp pain. "You can't just leave us!" I yell against the thick wood. "People know Ellery is here! Her grandmother dropped her off!" "I am aware," Peter says. There's a sound of something heavy being dragged across the floor, and I stop pounding so I can hear better. "Are you familiar with how a portable electric generator works, Malcolm?" I don't answer, and he continues. "It should never be turned on inside a house on account of the carbon monoxide it emits. It kills quickly in a concentrated area like this. I'm not sure how this got switched on, but oh well. Maybe you and Ellery knocked against it accidentally while you were down here doing who knows what. We may never know." My heart plummets to my feet as I twist the knob again.
"You locked us in here, Peter! They'll know it was you!"
"I'll be back in a little bit to open the door," Peter says casually. "I'm afraid I won't be able to stay long, though. Wouldn't want to meet the same fate. Plus, I need to head to the grocery store. We ran out of popcorn." A humming noise starts outside the door, and Peter raises his voice.
"I'd say it was nice knowing you, Malcolm, but quite honestly, you've been a nuisance from the start. All things considered, this has worked out fairly well. So long."
His footsteps recede quickly as I stand at the door, my head reeling and my heart pounding. How did I let it get to this point? Declan wouldn't have gone into the basement like a lemming. He would have tackled Peter in the bedroom, or... Light blazes behind me. I turn to see Ellery standing by the far wall with her hand on a switch, blinking like she just woke up. She goes back to the center of the room and kneels down in front of a box, ripping a thick strand of tape from its top. She turns the box upside down and dumps its contents on the floor. "There has to be something in here I can use to pick the lock." "Right," I say, relief flooding through me. I join her in tearing through the boxes. The first few are full of books, stuffed animals, and wrapping paper. "I'm sorry, Ellery," I say as we tear open more boxes. "I'm sorry I invited you over here, and that I let this happen. I wasn't quick enough." "Don't talk," she says shortly. "Save your breath."
"Right."
My head is starting to pound, and my stomach rolls, but I don't know whether that's stress or deadly gas. How long has Peter been gone? How much time do we have? Aha! Ellery says triumphantly, seizing a box of Christmas ornaments. Hooks! She yanks a couple free and heads for the door. I just need to straighten it and... She's silent for a few seconds, then lets out a grunt of frustration. These aren't strong enough. They just bend up. We need something else. Do you see any paper clips? Not yet. I open more boxes and root through their contents, but my head is pounding in earnest now, and I'm so dizzy that my vision is starting to fuzz around the edges. I struggle to stand up and look around the room. There are no windows to break, nothing heavy enough to use as a battering ram against the door. I upend more boxes, scattering their contents across the floor. At least we can make a mess, I think hazily. If nothing else, people might question what the hell happened in here. But my movements are sluggish and slowing by the second. All I want to do is lie down and go to sleep. I can't believe I'm thinking that already. I can't believe I finally learned what happened to Lacey and Brooke. Too late to give any kind of closure to their parents. I can't believe I won't get a chance to apologize to my brother. My eyes are drooping, so heavy that I nearly miss it glinting on the floor. One small, solitary paperclip. I dive for it with a strangled cry of triumph, but it's almost impossible to pick up. My hands feel rubbery and unwieldy, like I'm wearing giant Mickey Mouse gloves. When I finally get hold of it, I turn toward Ellery in the door. She's slumped in front of it, motionless. Ellery! I grab her by the shoulders and pull her into a sitting position, cupping her cheeks in my hands until I see her release a breath. I shake her as hard as I dare until her hair spills across her face. Ellery, come on! Wake up! Please! She doesn't respond. I lay her carefully on the floor and turn my attention to the paperclip. I can do this without her. I just need to unfold the clip and get to work. If only my hands hadn't turned into inflatable gloves, it would be a lot easier. If only my brain wasn't about to pound out of my head. If only I didn't have to stop to throw up. If only I could see. If only.
Chapter 36. Ellery. Friday, October 11th. I want to open my eyes, but the light is too bright and painful. It's quiet except for a soft beeping sound, and the air smells faintly of bleach. I try to raise one hand to the agony that's my head, but it won't move properly. Something's stuck in it, or to it. "Can you hear me?" asks a low voice. A cool, dry hand presses against my cheek. "Ellery, can you hear me?" I try to say yes, but it comes out more like a groan. My throat hurts, almost as much as my head. "I'm sorry. Don't talk." The hand leaves my face and curls around mine. "Squeeze, if you understand me." I do, weakly, and something wet drips on my arm. "Thank God. You'll be all right. They've used hyperbaric oxygen on you, and... well, I guess the details don't matter right now, but things look good. You look good. Oh, my poor girl." My arm is getting wetter.
I crack my eyes open a slit and see the faint outline of a room. Walls and a ceiling blending into one another with clean white lines, lit by the pale blue glow of fluorescent lighting. A gray head is bent in front of me, framed by shaking shoulders. "How?" I ask, but it doesn't sound like a word. My throat is as dry and rough as sandpaper. I try to swallow, but it's impossible without saliva. "How?" I rasp again. It's still unintelligible, even to my own ears, but my grandmother seems to understand. "Your brother saved you," she says. I feel like Sadie's robot character in The Defender. That does not compute. How did Ezra wind up in the Nilsons' basement? But before I can ask another question, everything fades again. The next time I wake, pale sunlight is streaming into the room. I try to sit up, until a figure in scrubs covered with sailboats gently forces me back down. "Not yet," a familiar voice says. I blink until Melanie Kilduff's face comes into focus. I want to talk to her, but my throat is on fire. "I'm thirsty," I croak. "I'll bet," she says sympathetically. "Just a few sips of water for now, though, okay?" She raises my head and puts a plastic cup to my lips. I drink greedily until she pulls it away. "Let's see how you do with that before you have any more." I'd protest, but my stomach is already rolling. At least it's a little easier to talk now, though. "Malcolm?" I manage. She places a comforting hand on my arm. "In a room down the hall. He'll be all right. And your mother is on her way." "Sadie? But she's not supposed to leave Hamilton House." "Oh, honey. Nobody cares about that right now." Everything about me feels as dry as dust, so it's surprising when tears start rolling down my cheeks. Melanie perches on the side of my bed and snakes her arms around me, folding me into a hug. My fingers curl onto her scrubs and clutch tight, pulling her closer. "I'm sorry," I rasp. "I'm so sorry about everything. Is Mr. Nilsson?" I trail off as my stomach lurches and I gag. Melanie raises me into more of a sitting position. "Throw up if you need to," she says soothingly. "Right here is fine." But the moment passes, leaving me exhausted and coated in clammy sweat. I don't say anything else for a long while, concentrating on getting my breathing under control. When I finally do, I ask again, "Where is he?" Melanie's voice is pure ice. "Peter's in jail, where he belongs." It's such an enormous relief that I don't even mind when I feel myself slipping into unconsciousness again. By the time Ryan visits, I almost feel like myself again. I've been awake for more than 30 minutes anyway, and I've managed to keep down an entire cupful of water. "You just missed Ezra," I tell him. "Nana made him leave. He'd been here for 7 hours straight.
Ryan lowers himself into the chair beside my bed.
I believe it, he says.
He's not in uniform, but wearing faded jeans and a flannel shirt instead. He gives me a nervous, lopsided smile that reminds me of Ezra's, and I wish, for one irrational second, that he'd hug me like Melanie did.
Your brother saved you, Nana had said.
She was right. I just didn't realize which one.
Thank you, I say.
Nana told me you came looking for us at the Nilsons, but nobody told me why. I search his open, friendly face, wondering how I ever could have imagined that it harbored dark secrets. My spidey sense is officially crap, which I'm sure Malcolm will tell me as soon as I'm allowed to see him.
I don't want to tire you out, Ryan starts tentatively, but I cut him off.
No, please, you won't. I promise. I need to know what happened.
Well, he hunches his shoulders and leans forward. I can't get into everything, but I'll tell you as much as I can. It's hard to know where to start, but it was probably with the bracelet Daisy gave me. She says she told you about that.
The bracelet? Really? I sit up so fast that I wince from the headache that suddenly hits me, and Ryan shoots me a worried look. I settle back into the pillows with pretend nonchalance.
I mean, okay. Sure. How so?
He regards me in silence for a few seconds, and I press my lips together so I won't accidentally vomit.
I didn't think much of it at the time, he finally says. I followed up with the jeweler, and she had no paper trail. She'd sold a bunch of bracelets around the same time and kept lousy records. Dead end, I thought. But I asked her to contact me if any similar sales took place. And last month she did. A guy bought the exact same bracelet and paid cash. When I asked her to describe him, he fit Peter to a T. Not that I realized it at the time. I didn't start connecting dots until you guys brought me that repair receipt. That made me question the whole Nilsson family. Then I asked Brooke's parents if I could look through her jewelry box. I have to make myself remember how to breathe.
And?
She had a bracelet exactly like Lacey's. Her mother didn't know when she'd gotten it, or from whom. But we had our own theories, obviously.
Right, right, I say sagely, like that had ever occurred to me even once.
At the same time, we were scouring Brooke's house for clues. Her phone had gone missing when she did, but we were able to seize her computer. There was a diary on it, buried among a bunch of school files and password protected. It took us a while to get it open, but once we did, we had most of the story. Brooke's side, anyway. She was cagey about names and details, but we knew she'd had an affair with someone older, that she'd been with him the night something terrible happened, and that she wanted to make things right. We had the car repair receipt, so we were starting to piece things together. But it was all still circumstantial. Then the Huntsburg police found Declan's ring at the crime scene. Ryan grimaces, burrowing his neck into his shoulders. I screwed up there when I questioned Declan. I was trying to rule him out while confirming that the ring was his, because at that point I was pretty sure he was getting framed. But I don't know. Declan and I have never had a great dynamic. I pushed too hard and raised doubts in Malcolm's head that didn't need to be there. If I could take anything back, it would be that. The machine next to me beeps quietly.
Okay, I say. But how did you show up in the nick of time? Why did you show up?
Your text,
Ryan says. I stare blankly at him, and his brows rise.
You didn't know?
You managed to get one letter off before Peter took your phone. All it said was P. I texted back a few times, but you didn't answer. I got worried with everything going on, so I checked in with your grandmother. When she said you were hanging out with Malcolm at the Nilsson's house, I freaked. I had done my best to get Mrs. Nilsson to leave the house with Malcolm while we were investigating, but she wouldn't leave. And then you show up there. I know how you are, always asking questions people don't want to answer. I headed over, thinking I'd make up some excuse to bring you back to Nora's. And I found... He trails off, swallowing visibly. I found you.
Where was Peter?
Ryan's expression darkens. Heading out of the house just as I was heading in. I guess he had gone back to the basement to drag you guys into the hallway so he wouldn't know you'd ever been locked in. He didn't say a word when he saw me, just got into his car and took off, which was enough to make me start tearing through the house. Thank God I heard the hum of the generator when I got into the kitchen, because you were nearly out of time. His mouth sets in a grim line. Peter almost made it to Canada before someone caught up with him. I can't talk about what we found in his car, but it was enough to tie him to Brooke's murder.
So, this is just a thing with him? Sleeping with teenage girls and killing them when they get in his way?
Malcolm had said that in the Nilsson's house while I stood silently beside him. Frozen and useless, like I hadn't spent nearly half my life preparing for the moment when I'd be lured into a killer's basement.
Looks like it. Mind you, he hasn't confessed to anything. And we don't have hard evidence when it comes to Lacey. Not yet. We don't know what the tipping point was with her. Profilers are analyzing Peter now, and they suspect that she likely wanted to take their affair public. That she threatened to tell his wife or something.
His second wife, right?
Yeah. She doesn't live in Echo Ridge anymore. But she lost her husband and son in a car accident before she married Peter. I think that's his particular brand of evil, acting like some kind of hero figure to vulnerable women while preying on young girls behind their backs.
Ryan's face twists with disgust. I don't know how else to explain why he'd marry the mother of Lacey's boyfriend. It's like he wanted to stay involved with Lacey or something.
I shudder, thinking back to Peter and Malcolm's mom in their kitchen, the first time I had gone to Malcolm's house. How charming he had been, but also, now that I have the benefit of hindsight, how controlling. Not letting his wife talk and maneuvering her out of the room, but doing it all with a smile. He had fooled me as much as anyone. What a twisted creep. The only thing that would have been worse is if Melanie's husband wasn't around and he had tried to hook up with her.
Agreed, Ryan says. Although Melanie never would have gone for it. She's tough. Alicia, not so much.
My heart aches for Malcolm and what this is going to mean for his family. Declan is finally in the clear, at least, and maybe once people realize Lacey was under Peter's influence, they won't judge him and Daisy too harshly. On the other hand, his mom. I can't even begin to imagine how she must feel, and how she's going to pick up the pieces from being married to somebody like Peter.
Ryan inches forward in his chair, his elbows on his knees, and his hands clasped together.
There's something I wanted to check in with you about. When I spoke to Malcolm, he said you asked Peter if he had done anything to Sarah. And that Peter whispered something he couldn't hear. What did Peter say?
My fingers find the worn edge of my blanket and pluck its loose threads.
I don't know. I couldn't hear him either.
His face falls.
Okay. He's not answering any of our questions, including the ones about Sarah. But don't worry. We'll keep at it.
What about Katrin? I ask abruptly. Why was she doing all that anonymous threat stuff? Was she trying to point people away from her dad or something?
No. That's another long story, Ryan says.
I lift my brows, and he adds,
Katrin wasn't involved in the threats at first. It was Vivian Cantrell who started them.
Viv? Why? What does she have to do with Peter? Were they having an affair too?
I almost gag at the thought.
Ryan huffs out a humorless laugh.
No, it was completely unrelated. She's applying to journalism programs this fall, and I guess some high-profile alumni told her that her portfolio wasn't strong enough to stand out. So she decided to manufacture a story she could report on.
I'm not sure I've heard him correctly. I almost have my head wrapped around Mr. Nilsson's warped psyche, but Viv's calculated plotting shocks me.
You have got to be kidding. She did all that crap, freaked people out, brought up horrible memories, and totally traumatized Lacey's parents, so she could write about it?
Yep, Ryan says grimly. And that's why you got dragged into it. Viv fixed the homecoming court election. She thought it'd be more newsworthy to have Sarah Corcoran's niece involved.
Newsworthy?
The word tastes bitter in my mouth.
Wow.
She's a special kind of horrible, isn't she? Ryan looks like he fully agrees, but all he says is, We traced the pep rally stunt back to her, and were about to talk with her parents when Brooke disappeared. Then we couldn't give the situation as much attention as we wanted, although we did let her know she was busted. She was terrified and swore up and down that she'd stop immediately. So I was surprised as hell when Malcolm turned up with that video.
Why would Katrin get involved, though?
Ryan hesitates. I'm sorry, but I can't tell you that. We're in discussions with Katrin's lawyer about what kind of role she's going to play in the investigation. Her reasons are part of those discussions, and they're confidential.
Did she know what her father was doing?
I press. Ryan folds his arms across his chest without answering.
Blink once for yes.
He snorts, but more in a fond sort of way than an annoyance, I think. New subject. I twist the blanket between my hands.
So you had the whole thing figured out, and all this time I've just been getting in your way.
Does that about sum it up? Not entirely. The repair receipt was genuinely useful, especially knowing how much Brooke wanted to find it. When we added it to the bracelet in her diary, we knew who we were dealing with.
He gives me a half smile.
Plus, you almost getting killed gave us probable cause to search Peter's car, so thanks for that.
Anytime. My eyelids are getting heavy, and I have to blink fast to keep them from drooping. Ryan notices and gets to his feet.
I should go. Let you get some rest.
Will you come by again? He looks flattered at the hopeful tone in my voice.
Yeah, sure. If you want me to.
I do. I let my eyes close for a second, then force them open again as he stands. Thanks again. For everything.
You're welcome, he says,
shoving his hands in his pockets awkwardly. For that moment, he reminds me of the old Officer Rodriguez, the skittish, subpar cop, instead of the crack investigator he turned out to be.
Hey, so this is maybe not the time or the place, he adds hesitantly. But If you're feeling well enough, my sister's having a fall open house in a couple of weeks. She does it every year. She wants to meet you and Ezra, if you're up for it.
She does? I ask, surprised. I'd almost forgotten that Ryan has siblings.
Yeah, but no pressure or anything.
Just think about it. You can let me know later if you're interested. He smiles warmly and lifts one hand in a wave. Then he turns, disappearing into the hallway. I sink back onto the thin pillow, my haze of tiredness suspended. I've almost gotten used to Ryan, but I'm not sure how to feel about even more strangers that I'm related to. Going from a family tree of three, four, with Nana, to this sudden influx of half-siblings, their spouses, and their kids seems like a lot. I kind of like the idea of a sister, though. Maybe a half one wouldn't be bad. There's a rustling sound at the door, and the scent of jasmine. I half twist on the bed and spy a cloud of dark curls framed in the doorway. Ellery, Sadie breathes, her blue eyes sparkling with tears. Before I can remember that I'm mad at her, I'm returning her hug with every ounce of strength I have left.
Chapter 37. Malcolm. Saturday, October 26th. This kid hates me, Declan says. I don't think he's wrong. The six-month-old baby he's holding is sitting stiff as a board on his knee, red-faced and screaming. Everybody at this party feels sorry for the kid, except Daisy. She's beaming like she's never seen anything so adorable. I can practically see her ovaries exploding, Mia murmurs beside me. You're holding him wrong, Ezra says. He scoops the baby up in one deft motion, cradling him in the crook of his arm. Just relax. They can tell when you're nervous. The kid stops crying and gives Ezra a giant, toothless grin. Ezra tickles his stomach before holding him out toward Declan. Try again. No, thanks, Declan mutters, getting to his feet. I need a drink. A pretty dark-haired woman climbs the porch stairs, squeezing Ezra's arm as she passes. You're so good with him. She's the baby's mother, Ryan Rodriguez's sister, and we're all hanging out at her house 2 weeks after Peter Nilsson's murder attempt, like everything's back to normal. I don't know. Maybe it is, or maybe we're finally figuring out that we haven't been normal for years and it's time to redefine the word. Declan heads for a cooler in the backyard, and Mia nudges my arm. No time like the present, she says. I glare at my brother's back. Why is it even my responsibility? He's older. He should extend the olive branch first. Mia adjusts her cat's eye sunglasses. You thought he was guilty of murder. Yeah, well, Ellery suspected me at one point. I got over it. Ellery had known you for less than a month then. She wasn't your brother. He didn't even visit me in the hospital. She enunciates every word carefully. You thought he was guilty of murder. I almost got murdered. You could do this all day, or you could be the bigger person. Mia waits a beat, then punches me in the arm. At least he showed up. All right, fine, I grumble and take off after Declan. I wasn't sure he'd be here. We've only spoken a couple of times since I was released from the hospital, mostly to sort stuff out related to Mom. That's a mess. All of Peter's assets are frozen, so she's got nothing to her name except a bank account that won't cover more than a couple months' worth of expenses. We'll be moving to Salisbury soon, and while I can't get out of the Nilsson's house fast enough, I don't know what happens after that. Mom hasn't worked in over a year, and my dad's harder to reach than ever. We got a semi-lucrative offer to tell our side of the story to a tabloid, but we're not desperate enough to take it. Yet. Declan's at the far corner of the yard, pulling a frosted brown bottle from a blue cooler. He twists the cap off and takes a long sip, then catches sight of me and lowers the bottle. I'm a few feet away when I notice how white his knuckles are. "What's up, little brother?" "Can I have one?" I ask. He snorts. "You don't drink." "I might need to start." Declan reopens the cooler and plunges his hand into its depths, extracting a bottle identical to the one he's holding. He hands it to me, expressionless, and I manage to get the top off without wincing when the sharp edges cut into my palm. I take a tentative sip, waiting for bitterness to explode in my mouth, but it's not half bad. Smooth and almost honey-flavored. I'm nervous and thirsty, and a quarter of the bottle is gone before Declan grabs my arm. "Slow down." I meet his eyes and force out the words I've been practicing for 2 weeks. "I'm sorry." Seconds pass that feel like minutes. I'm ready for just about any response, for him to yell at me, to walk away without saying anything, even to sock me in the jaw. The bruises from Kyle's attack are almost gone, just in time for some new ones. But Declan doesn't do any of those things. He sips his beer, then clinks his bottle against mine. "Me too," he says. The bottle almost slips out of my hand.
"What?"
"You heard me."
"So you're not..."
I trail off. "You're not mad" still seems impossible. Declan looks back at the porch we left, squinting in the bright sun. It's one of those incredible late October days we get sometimes in Vermont, upper 70s with an almost cloudless blue sky, the trees around us exploding with color. Daisy is holding the baby now, talking earnestly with Ryan's sister. Mia and Ezra are sitting side by side on the wooden railing, legs dangling and their heads bent close together. The sliding door to the house opens, and a girl steps outside, dark curls bouncing around her shoulders. I've been waiting for her to show up, but I guess I can wait to talk a little longer. "I've been a shit brother to you, Mal," Declan says finally. "For years, I'm not gonna lie, I didn't give a crap about you when we were kids. Too caught up in my own stuff. And you weren't, I don't know, enough like me for me to pay attention." A muscle in his cheek jumps, his eyes still on the porch. "Then everything went to hell and I took off. I didn't think about you then either, not for years. So I'm not sure why I expected you to be on my side when somebody found my class ring at a murder site." My throat's uncomfortably dry, but I don't want any more beer. "I should have realized you didn't have anything to do with that." Declan shrugs.
"Why?
We barely know each other. And I'm the adult, or so they tell me, so that's on me." He opens the cooler again and pulls out a ginger ale, holding it out to me. I hesitate, and he takes the beer from my hand, setting it down on a nearby table. "Come on, Mal. That's not you." I take the ginger ale. "I don't know what's going to happen with Mom." "I don't either. That shit's not great. We'll figure it out, though. You guys can get a place near Daisy and me. Salisbury's all right." He grins and takes a sip of beer. "The regulars at Bukowski's Tavern aren't half bad when you get to know them." The tightness in my chest loosens. "Good to know." A wisp of a cloud passes over the sun, briefly shading Declan's face. "You talk to Katrin?" he asks. No, I say. She ended up cooperating fully with the DA's office, handing off one final piece of evidence. Brooke's cell phone case. Katrin had found it the day Peter organized the search party, after she'd gone digging through his office looking for a phone charger. Apparently, Peter destroyed Brooke's phone but kept the case, as though it were some kind of sick trophy, just like he had with Lacey's ring. It wasn't something you'd find in a store. Brooke had made it herself with a clear case, dried flowers, and nail polish. It was one of a kind. And when Katrin saw it tucked away like that, she knew her father was involved. Instead of turning him in, she'd recreated one of Viv's anonymous threats to try to deflect attention. Katrin's lawyer painted as sympathetic a picture of her as he could. He claimed Peter had methodically estranged Katrin from her mother for years so he could control and manipulate her, to the point where she was totally dependent on him and unable to distinguish right from wrong. A different type of victim from Lacey and Brooke, but still a victim. And maybe she was. Is. I don't know, because I haven't answered the one text she sent me since she was released into her aunt's custody. Katrin isn't allowed out of the country, and her mother's not willing to move here. He's all I have. I didn't answer. Not only because it wasn't true, she'd had me and my mom at the very least, plus her aunt and even Theo and Viv, but because I can't think about my stepsister without remembering the last time I saw Brooke in her driveway, glancing back at me over her shoulder before she went inside. Soon after, according to the police, she slipped out again to meet up with Peter. I don't think I can ever accept the fact that Katrin knew Peter was involved in her best friend's disappearance and stood by him anyway. Maybe one of these days, when everything is less raw, I can try to understand what it was like to grow up with that toxic sewer for a father. But 2 weeks after he tried to kill me isn't that time. Probably a good thing. That whole family's rotten to the core, Declan says, taking another long pull at his bottle. Anyway, you and Mom should come over for dinner this week. Daisy and I bought a grill. I start laughing. Holy hell! You bought a grill! You're holding babies! What's next, suburban dad? You gonna start talking about your lawn? Declan narrows his eyes, and for a second I think I've gone too far. Then he grins. There are worse fates, little brother. Much worse fates. He turns toward the porch again, shading his eyes against the sun. Ellery has her hands clasped stiffly in front of her as she talks to Ryan's sister. Why are you still over here yapping at me? Go get your girl. She's not my... I start, and Declan shoves me. Only a little too hard. Don't be such a wuss, Mal, he instructs, pulling the ginger ale from my hand. But he smiles when he says it. So I leave him, crossing the yard toward the porch. Ellery spots me when I'm about halfway there and waves. She says something to her half-sister, then bounds down the stairs with an energy that sets my nerves jumping. I've seen her only a couple of times since we left the hospital, always with some combination of Ezra, Mia, or her grandmother around. I even saw Sadie briefly before she went back to rehab. Ellery and I aren't alone here either, but for a few seconds in the middle of the backyard, everybody else fades away, and it feels like it. Hey, she says, stopping within a foot of me. I was hoping you'd be here. Her eyes flick over my shoulder to Declan. How'd that go? Better than expected. How are things with your new half-siblings? Same, she says. Better than expected. They're nice. I'm not as comfortable with the other two as I am with Ryan, though. Ezra's fitting in more easily than I am, as usual. She brushes a stray curl off her temple.